we ended last time with the thought that empirical concepts do not require a schema because they are intrinsically applicable to the appearances, because in most cases they've been derived from the appearances. So it's natural to think of standard, everyday empirical concepts, mathematical concepts, and even the standard concepts of natural science as being their own schemata, which is to say, there's no problem. We don't worry about that. And the thought that there could be a problem, how do I apply an ordinary concept, misses the point. Ordinary concepts just are intrinsically applicable. Schematism is an issue only where there is a genuine gap between concept and object. And we've discovered that the only place in which there is a genuine gap between concept and object are those special concepts of transcendental philosophy, namely the pure concepts of the understanding. Categories are not yet cast in terms of properties and or relations that can actually be manifested by objects given through sensibility. Kant argues, in order for this to be the case, we require something that will create a homogeneity or something that is the same between concept and object. Obviously, Kant says at A138, obviously, I would think that Kant would not use that word, since there's nothing obvious in anything that he ever wrote. Obviously, there must be some third thing, which is homogeneous on the one hand with the category, and on the other hand with the appearance, and which thus makes the application of the former to the latter possible. This mediating representation must be pure, that is, devoid of all content. Misread it. It's devoid of all empirical content. And yet at the same time, while it must in one respect be intellectual, it must in another be sensible. Such a representation is a transcendental schema. So as we discovered last time, that which mediates between the pure concept and sensible is going to be located in the imagination. Imagination as a source of mediation between the intelligible and the sensible, amongst the many problems later failed to solve. Now, the important thing here is that, despite my reference to Plato, all this is still Hume's problem. For the thought here is there is no impression of necessary connection. Right? That is, I see one thing, and then I see another. I see the eraser standing up. I don't see my finger. I don't see, we'll have to come back later to this issue. I don't see my finger knocking over the eraser. I first see my finger approach and then touch the eraser, and then I see the eraser falling. That's all that we intuit, which is to say, that's all that is available at the level of apprehension. And you'll see throughout the analogies, Kant uses that word apprehension, because it's apprehension that, so to speak, is devoid of what we need here. Namely, something that would connect my finger touching the eraser and the eraser falling. So no impression of a necessary connection between the one and the other, nor do we have, according to you, an impression of existence in addition to the impressions of the particular properties of external objects. Causality and externality for you are, he is saying, properties which should be presented in empirical intuition, but he could not find them. And because he could not find them, he was a skeptic. And there was a gap. And so severe a gap, I want to be clear, even for you, so severe a gap in our empirical knowledge that he had to find some analog of causality that cohered with the evidence presented. Kant concedes Hume's problem. There really is the lack of an intuition here. And again, the whole strategy of the critique is that we, through our forms of synthesis, as it were, are going to supply the missing item. But that would be tawdry anthropomorphism if we simply projected upon the world, kind of arbitrarily, what we'd like to find there. So that can't be the way it happens. The way it happens has to run through the idea that the use of these pure intellectual concepts, concepts which we do not find instantiated in the world, are nonetheless necessary conditions for the very possibility of the simplest bit of empirical knowledge, and indeed necessary, as we'll see in the recognition of idealism, for the possibility of experience überhaupt. So, we want something to make the categories homogeneous with appearances. And I guess we might think that there are three criteria which this mediating medium must have. First, if this is really gonna do the work that Kant wants it to do, it better apply to all appearances. So it better be something that is an aspect that holds universally of all appearances. Otherwise, it would be just contingent. Secondly, if it's to hold universally, then it needs to be something that can be known a priori, and therefore preserve the a priori status of the categories. And whatever it is, it must be sufficiently complex, sufficiently heterogeneous, sufficiently diverse, so that the logical properties and relations that it possesses can have different interpretations. Otherwise, we'd only like work for one category, right? We need something that could actually be sufficiently rich so that not just one category, but all the different things that categories do get articulated thereby. Kant says that only one item magically fulfills all three criteria. Next time. So he says, very just carrying on from where I left off meeting, the concept of understanding contains pure synthetic unity, the manifold in general. Time, as the formal condition of the manifold of inner sense, and therefore of the connection of all representations, contains an a priori manifold in pure intuition. So time, as the form of inner sense, which is to say, of anything I might experience, inner or outer, because even things that I experience as outer must also be perceived and therefore be experienced and therefore affect my inner sense. So only time holds of all our experiences. And furthermore, because time is the form of inner sense, it's knowable a priori. Now, a transcendental determination of time, so what we're going to do, or what we're going to find, is that this, what was this pure, empty intuition of time, is subject to a priori determinations. That is, prior to, in anticipation of all possible experience, we must conceive of time as having a certain structural complexity and unity. I'll say more about that in a moment. And that this structural complexity and unity is precisely the application of the pure categories to it in such a way that thereby anything that appears in time becomes subject to those categories. Right? So it's via the transcendental determinations of time that the categories reach out and determine not just the conditions of possibility of experience, but the conditions for the possibility of the objects of experience. Because time is a form of sense, therefore passivity, therefore the condition of making appearing to us. Now, a transcendental determination of time insofar is so far homogeneous with category, which constitutes its unity, in that it is universal and rests upon an a priori rule. But on the other hand, it is so far homogeneous with appearance, in that time is contained in every empirical representation of the manifold. Right? So, on the one hand, as a priori, it's on the side of the categories. On the other hand, because it's the form, it's that form through which anything can affect us, it's on the side of sense. So time is necessarily both purely a priori and sensible at the same time, pardon the pun. Thus, an application of a category to appearances become possible by means of a transcendental determination of time, which as the schema of the concepts of the understanding mediates the subsumption of appearances under the category. Only time, not space, is fully universal. However, as Kant will repeat throughout the analogies, and even more so in the refutation of idealism, time is not itself directly or immediately perceivable. Particular, and I'll come back to this argument later on, the thought is particular temporal relations are not directly perceived, and this will entail that particular determinations of temporal relations, and for the moment, indeed, perhaps not even for the moment, let's say forever in eternity, there really are only are two temporal relations. Things either are at the same time, simultaneity, or they are in some order of succession. So that particular determinations of those temporal relations of succession or simultaneity of any given appearance will turn out to depend upon the cognizance of some spatial relation, even though spatial relations are also not directly perceived, just to keep matters complicated, and recognition of them will depend upon the dynamic relations of objects in space. So, as I suggested last time, there's going to be a mutual determination of time and space, even though there is a logical or transcendental priority of time over space, for the reasons I just gave, the threefold criteria of schematism. Thus, the contents of the transcendental schemata are supplied by the several transcendental determinations of time. However, the use of these schemata, not the schemata themselves, but their actual use, and thus the categories themselves, require objects in space. Okay. So the premise of all of this stuff and what's going to be governing the argument of the analogies is Kant's reiterated claim that time cannot be perceived. He states this both as an introduction to the analogies of experience at B219, so he says there, just so we get ourselves for apprehension is only placing together the manifold of empirical intuition, and we find in it no representation of any necessity which determines the appearances thus combined to have connected existence in space and time. That is a restatement of view. But since experience is knowledge of objects through perceptions, the relation involved in the existence of the manifold has to be represented in experience, not as it comes to be constructed in time, but as it exists objectively in time. That is, what we want to know is, what's the real temporal order of events? And I'll say why that's a problem in a moment. But the premise of it all now is, the next sentence, since time, however, cannot itself be perceived, the determination of the existence of objects in time can take place only through their relation in time in general, and therefore only through concepts that connect them a priori. And he repeats that premise. I won't read all the passages. In each of the analogies, that is at B225 for the first analogy, B233 for the second analogy, and B257 for the third analogy. At B291.2, connects that problem of time determination to space. And all of this, by the way, should be just taken as proleptic. I'm going to detail these arguments, but I think a little prolepsis never hurt anyone, especially on an early Wednesday evening. But it is even more noteworthy the fact that in order to understand the possibility of things in conformity with the categories, and so to demonstrate the objective reality of the latter, we need not merely intuitions, but intuitions that are in all cases outer intuitions. The person who failed to understand this profoundly, of course, was Heidegger. Being in time. I refer you to Lillian Alweiss's book on the topic. It shows that there is a temporal monism in Heidegger and a failure to really take seriously the problem of externality. unlike
Sarah. Sarah was a good contact.
Okay. At A200B 245, Kahn explains what he means by this doctrine. A200, B245 is the argument about empty time, time not being perceived. Now, since absolute time is not an object of perception, this determination of position cannot be derived from the relation of appearances to it. On the contrary, the appearances must determine for one another their position in time and make their time order a necessary order. Okay, of course, given that time is the form of inner sense, then the appearance of successiveness can be granted as given, at least in some sense. I won't quibble about that yet. I'll quibble about it later. The thesis is that individual appearances do not come with their correct temporal location labeled on them, nor do we have access to some measure of temporal position. So to use the example I used last week, I look at the jean jacket. I look at the television set. I look at the jean jacket. Okay, so we have an order. Jacket, television, jacket. Where in time are these two objects? Anyone? Yeah, they're in the same time. How do I know that? That's simply the puzzle. How do I know that? I see them successively, right? But they're somehow at the same time. Now, what we're missing here is what we would want is maybe a little clock above every object that would give the place and absolute time. Like 17477, and then I look over there, 17477, and it would always be at the skin, and then I'd know, right? But they don't come labeled like that. And yet, we do know. So, Kahn's not contesting that we know. He's taking, for reasons I'll come to, he's taking for granted that we know. The question, the good old transcendental question is, how possible? So, dynamic interactions among the objects are going to be required because although spatial extension, unlike temporal succession, actually exists in one moment of time, The jean jacket is just there for the hat. It doesn't need a synthesis for its extension. And therefore, spatial objects can be objects of a singular representation. See it. Position in absolute space is not given in a single representation. No more does the jean jacket come with, as it were, its vectorial counters with respect to everything else, or its exact location in absolute space. Rather, existing objects which cannot be simultaneously perceived, TV, jean jacket, can be no more directly perceived than can position in absolute time. That is, even spatially, I've got to know, right, that the TV is to the left of, to the right of the television. So on. And, you know, so on. I have to map out it in relationship to one another. Therefore, I have to set up relations between these objects in order to get their spatial location. And all of this, by the way, is going to be ratcheted up a notch when we come to the refutation of idealism, where Kant denies that even knowledge of successiveness of perceptions in inner sense can be known without foundation. That is, even successiveness of perceptions in inner sense has its own conditions of possibility. Namely, knowledge of the independent existence of objects in space is, at any rate, the most basic. So Kant is going to argue that inner awareness is dependent on outer awareness. And therefore deny the premise of all rationalism and empiricism. Namely, that we begin with autonomous inner awareness and build out to the world.
What's the difference between inner awareness and inner sense? Because, I mean, it's inner awareness or inner experience that sort of Kant hammers on in refutation. But with respect to the time determination, it's a question of inner sense.
Inner sense is the medium. Inner awareness is our knowledge of what's going on in the inner sense. So inner sense is just his label for what's called the theater of consciousness. And it can be known, it is knowable in the same way, no better, no worse, no more directly or indirectly than outer experience, it turns out. So it turns out that there's no privilege of the inner over the outer. So the very foundations of all modern philosophy didn't even make it 150 years. Okay, so that's where we're going. That's all the anticipation. Having now set up what the schematism is going to do, Kant very mechanically, and to my mind not very convincingly, states for each of the categories a temporal correlate, which of course fall into four types corresponding to the four kinds of categories, namely time series, time content, time order, and the scope of time. By time series, he means number, quantity. By time content, he means something that exists, and he's talking about what fills time, and what fills time will be somewhere, we'll call it more than zero and less than one, which is to say that every sensation will have, every sensation will represent a quantum of intensity in its object, of which, if you want an analogy, you can think of how bright a light is shining, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 watt bulb, brighter and brighter, right? And so, and that's true roughly now of every sensation for Kant. So it's got to be more than zero, or there'd be nothing. And it has to be less than one, or we would be zapped. Time order is the analogies of experience. And the scope of time refers to the logical modalities that then receive a temporal determination. Now, I don't think it's worth detailing all of this because it's a kind of derivation. You know, he just simply kind of mechanically goes from the category and then comes up with the temporal determination matching it. And it's Kant at his most architectonic and utterly unconvincing. And in fact, in the principles, he does something much more interesting. Namely, he does not overtly or explicitly rely on the logical functions of judgment or the list of categories, but proceeds as if he was simply providing each with an appropriate temporal determination. Or rather, he proceeds as if from the very notion of time order as a problem. So you don't have to believe this kind of elaborate architectonic junk. Because Kant really does the hard work in the analogies. Or to put it another way, the transcendental deduction does not explicitly, the results in transcendental do not explicitly structure the analogies of experience. Rather, he works directly from the problem of the determination of time. I will not, although another place and time would be fun to look at the axioms and anticipations of perception. The axioms, anticipations are, why skip them? Because it's not really about time determination at all, for one thing. For another, although interesting, the axioms represent Kant's argument about why nature is completely mathematizable, and it's roughly because of space and time as being pure forms of intuition, then the empirical representations of any empirical object must have some extensive magnitude, as space and time does, be countable, measurable, and the like. And I've already, in a way, given you the argument for the anticipation of perception, namely that objects' corresponding stations must have some intensive magnitude, an argument that I will suggest later really turns on Kant's theory of matter. And I'll come to that later. So the schematism really simply sets up the background for the analogies, setting up this problem of time determination. So let me say a few words about the background, structural background to the analogies, and we'll have a break. I've already suggested that we cannot directly inspect time itself. As a consequence, no object's position in time is directly determinable. Kant, from the transcendental aesthetic, assumes there can only be one time. Time persists in the sense that it does not pop in and out of existence as its moments do. Notice neither simultaneity on its own or succession on its own will guarantee the unity of time. Why? Well, let's say we can generate simultaneity. Then it would follow we'd simply have as many worlds as we had moments. So simultaneity will just give us a kind of leaping from world to world, right? For those of you who are fans of Doctor Who, it kind of seems like that sometimes. That's what he does. He moves from time to time, and there is no one time, I think. A great debate, please. Succession on its own will generate simply multiple chains of time, right? But they can then exist parallel to one another, and again, with no, so again, many times, again, not one. So neither simultaneity by itself, nor succession by itself, gives us anything like a unity of time. So the possibility of experience which is now going to mean for Kant, new translation, the possibility of temporal experience, is going to have to involve the experience of objects, all of them, in one and the same time, and this is going to be a necessary condition for the possibility of experience. So there has to be an in principle connectability of all experience. The idea then of the unity of experience, so we'll get the idea of unity of experience, which we can see we, as it were, desperately need. No unity of experience, no knowledge, is going to be the case if and only if there is a unity of time and a unity of time will generate what it means to have a unity of world or nature. So that there is such a thing as the world or nature is simply an artifact of the unity of time, which is a necessary condition for the unity of experience, or at least Kant says so at A216. By nature, in the empirical sense, we understand the connection of appearances as regards their existence according to necessary rules, that is, according to law. There are certain laws which first make nature possible, and these laws are a priori. Empirical laws can exist and be discovered only through experience, and in consequence of those original laws which experience itself first becomes possible. Our analogies, therefore, really portray, that is, the rules themselves. There must be substance, every event has a cause, objects exist in thoroughgoing interaction with one another. Those three principles, the analogies, really portray the unity of nature in the connection of all appearances under certain exponents, which express nothing save the relation of time to the unity of apperception. So you think, the I think. Which of course portrays the necessary conditions for the unity of experience. Now it turns out to be the flip side of the unity of nature. That they mutually define one another. I think and the world are internal, transcendental correlatives. Taken together, the analogies thus declare that all appearances lie, must lie, in one nature, because without this a priori unity, no unity of experience, and therefore no determination of objects in it would be possible. So in generating the three analogies, which I am now suggesting must be used together, all three of them, no one without all. There's been an obsessive look at the second analogy in the analytic literature, and that's simply a mistake. I'm suggesting Kant thinks of them as jointly generating, hence my argument about the relations of simultaneity and succession, jointly generating the unity of time and therefore the unity of nature. And that turns out to be the true correlative of the I think. Now, one may ask, since there are only two modes of time, succession or simultaneity, how come there's three analogies? And the argument, that question, can be traced back to the structure of the analogies as a whole as a form of argumentation. Namely, it always begins with the premise that the representations are always successive. I see one thing after another. That fact, that inner sense, consciousness is temporal. That's all I'm saying here, right? I always see one thing after another, experience one thing after another, always. Successiveness is, you know, even before James Joyce, we knew this was how things go, right? Before Faulkner, before Proust. But the question then arises, should my representations, which are always successive, be taken as representing successive or coexistent states of affairs? Should my representations be taken as showing change or no change? Again, it's all succession for me, from the inside, and yet, of course, that's not quite how I experience the world. I don't experience the world as mere succession. I experience it sometimes as no change. There's that damn jacket. There's that damn TV. No change whatsoever. And sometimes I experience change. Your head moving from there to there. Now, Kant going to claim that in order to make either judgment, either a judgment of successiveness, which is to say there really has been an event, or a judgment of enduringness, nope, just different perceptual takes of an unchanging object. It happens all the time. Indeed, ultimately requires the presupposition of enduring and indeed ultimately permanent objects governed by laws of causation or interaction. That is, it is going to commit us to the idea that there is substance and that the determinations of substance are governed by thoroughgoing laws of causation and interaction. Therefore, again, there is an interdependence of all three analogies. And in therefore constructing their relations to one another, we construct the very idea of nature and world. Okay, let us stop there, but do not move, for it is a last, that time when we call what we call the revenge of the student, when you get to evaluate.